We're talking about the work of public health officers here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the battle against COVID, public health workers, they're on the front lines. Across the country, they've faced a wave of threats and pressure amid the response. An Associated Press and Kaiser Health News review from August found dozens of state and local public health leaders have resigned, have retired, or been pushed out of their jobs since April. What do you want to know from a former public health official what it's like to manage in a pandemic? Do you work in public health or maybe in contact tracing? How are you holding up? We're at 800-642-1234 to join the conversation. Tim Lawther is the former health officer of Sauk County Health Department. He resigned earlier this month. Tim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Glad to be here.
So why did you decide to leave your post amid a pandemic?
Well, it was a very difficult decision. And of course, you could easily say it was a questionable time to leave in the middle of a major emergency. But the reality is that the national political scene has trickled down to the local level. And the political games that folks are playing really have empowered people in positions of leadership to not role model appropriate behavior, to really sort of negate the science and really create this sort of false us versus them dichotomy in so many ways that it really struggled to actually have any impact or see any impact that I was making. The science versus conspiracy, us versus them, mask versus no mask. You know, these are all very simplistic political tools to get people to jump onto one side or another, but ultimately they're fake and they're false. And they really make good public health and keeping people safe and healthy incredibly, incredibly difficult. And I just did not think that I was making an impact anymore. And so I had to move on.
And so in the terms of the challenges that you were facing within your department through the early months and mid months here of the pandemic, what types of challenges were you coming up against? Was it beyond the rhetoric?
I think the challenge with rhetoric is that it gets louder and louder and louder with more people speaking it such that it becomes policy and fact after a while. And I think that was really sort of the struggle here, really. I mean, initially, of course, the problems were that this was a brand new virus. We didn't know what to expect. We didn't know what it was going to do, how it was going to act. And so all of those initial things we were learning as we were going, and that was challenging for everybody. But once we sort of got a little slightly better handle on that and started to put forth guidance, public health guidance to keep people safe and healthy, that's when the rhetoric really turned into barriers and struggles for public health officials, I think, to really sort of get in there and do what they think is right based on the science and the data.
I'm wondering, do public health officers feel like they have a network around them of their peers in other counties, in other states, where they can look at each other and say, hey, what are you doing? Can we replicate this? Or what's not working? What is working? How strong is the network?
Well, there absolutely is some of that. I mean, there is across the state. There are very, very frequent calls and opportunities to communicate with your health officer colleagues. You know, in our region, there were 14 counties in our region, and we engaged formally every week and certainly talked many more times than that. You know, there are national organizations and associations, and there are a lot of folks out there putting guidance and best practices out. So, you know, I think there is a little bit of a network. I think that it's not as strong as it could be, obviously, but I think that there is a network there, and there's a lot of support among public health officials because we're all experiencing, very similar things. You know, the political realities of each community are different, obviously, but the reality of the virus is pretty similar everywhere that we're going. And so that network needs some support and needs some encouragement, but it absolutely is there.
We're talking with former Sauk County Health Officer Tim Lawther, who's our guide to what public health workers are facing amid the pandemic. Taking your questions, your experiences, what do you want to know from a former public health official about what it's like to be in charge of public health in the pandemic? Do you work in public health? Do you think that the state is doing enough to support the needs of frontline healthcare workers like you? We're at 800-642-1234. Tim, we're watching our state just reeling from the surge, the uptick in cases. They're just sky high. What do you make of this as you look at it from a public health lens?
Well, obviously, this is not something any of us want to see, whether you're in public health or anyplace else. But you're right. I mean, Wisconsin is quite a hotbed of coronavirus cases at this point. They are growing around this entire country. And, ultimately, I think that is the inevitable result of, the initial lack of any sort of national model or national plan or national guidance on how we were going to do this. And so ultimately what happened is without that national leadership, the state struggled to get itself in a position where they could control an epidemic that did not stop at its own borders. So very difficult for states to do that. And then ultimately, of course, after the Supreme Court Palm decision came down, it really fell to the local communities to really sort of manage an international pandemic, which makes no sense whatsoever and was destined to fail. And I think that we're now sort of reaping the challenges of that poor planning and that poor execution initially, 6-7 months ago when this all started.
So that you get like this patchwork approach to how to fight the pandemic, and that patchwork makes the virus more difficult to respond to?
That's exactly right. I mean, if you do it at a very simplistic level, in our region, where Sauk County and Dane County both exist, each county had different plans, different intervention, different guidelines, different orders. Very few had orders, but different ways that they were going to protect their community or interact with this virus. And the virus does not respect those political boundaries of counties. And so it is really silly to expect that the smallest level of municipal government can, in fact, control a pandemic across the country. It's not going to work that way. And so we need that national, we need that state level leadership so individual counties can adapt what they need to their particular environments, but that ultimately there is some coordinated response that doesn't make it that if I drive 10 feet, I have a different rule than if I go backwards 10 feet because the county line has changed. It's a silly way to manage anything, quite frankly, but certainly a silly way to manage a global pandemic.
Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The cases in Wisconsin are going up and in the United States have gone up, obviously. I know the guest talked about not having a national strategy, but they're really going up all around the world. I read an article on NPR, I think it was last week, that said 2 weeks ago in Europe, cases went up 700,000 cases. So it's not just a U.S. lack of national policy. It's a worldwide issue, and I want to know what the guest comment is about that.
Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There are cases. They're not going up everywhere, obviously. Some places are a little bit more immune to this than others, but you're right. They're going up all over the world. I'm not meaning here to sit here and suggest that, the United States has failed while everybody else has succeeded. The reality is that whenever you're in a situation that is international, you need leadership. And frequently, rightly or wrongly, frequently the United States has been in the position of leadership globally to sort of address these global public health crises. We did that with Ebola. We did that with H1N1. There are several other examples. We did not do that with this particular issue. So I can't pretend to know what would have happened had we done that. But I do know that the United States is certainly in a position where I think that we could have been a little bit more aggressive in our leadership role, not only internally to this country, but across the world, and in terms of our support to the World Health Organization, for example. So I'm not suggesting that it's our fault that this is happening by any stretch of the imagination, but I am suggesting that there are opportunities to learn from what we've done to try to make it better before this is over.
Tim Lother, former health officer for Sauk County Health Department, we're discussing the work of public health in these stressful times. Do you live in a county that has surging cases? How are you feeling? Are people wearing masks out and about? What steps do you think the government should take to combat the dramatic rise of COVID cases in our state, in our country, in our world? It's 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Tim Lother here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing the difficult work of public health officers who are on the front lines of the pandemic. In California, more than a dozen public health leaders have left their jobs amid harassment over their role in mask rules and stay-at-home orders. It's reporting by Kaiser Health News. California's governor signed an executive order expanding privacy protections in response to threats aimed at public health officers. Do you work in public health? What do you want people to understand? What are you experiencing as you combat the effects of a surging virus? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have Tim Lothar with us, former health officer for Sauk County, and he's our guide. Let's take another call now. Kim is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Kim. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just want to say I was sorry to hear that you resigned. But one thing you did mention is with the political atmosphere right now, I'm not surprised at resignation. And I'm actually surprised that we're not seeing more public health officials resign across Wisconsin. And that kind of brings up my question. The public health officials right now in each county, are they just going along with, like, the committees? Or are they, is their voice kind of being staunch right now? Like, why aren't we seeing county-by-county mask mandates, too?
So how are public health officers working with elected officials on things like the mask mandate?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. And, you know, the reality is that in Wisconsin, that is county specific. So each county, after the Supreme Court ruling, the Palm decision came down, where the state basically sort of stepped out of that role and left it to each individual county or municipality to define how it was going to issue public health orders. The reality is that public health officials in each one of those counties is operating, differently. And so in some counties where that relationship is really very strong, there's a strong support of the political leadership to public health, then you see orders, you see role modeling of public health prevention measures like mask wearing and social distancing. You see public support for those public health interventions that we've been working with for so long. In counties where that relationship isn't so good the understanding of public health isn't so great, then what you see is there are no orders and there are, community meetings that folks are not wearing masks and they're sitting right next to each other, not socially distanced. You know, so those types of simple things are the things that sort of go forward, and everybody in the county then sees what the leadership is doing and then, makes the decisions about how it's going to act. I share Kim's surprise that more folks have not resigned. I have talked to many of my former colleagues who are frustrated and stressed out and trying to find ways to support their staff who are spending, every day of the week, 7 days a week, often into the evening, talking to folks with positive coronavirus or close contacts, and they're getting beaten down constantly. At some point, this has got to change. We've got to get out of this, as I said earlier, this us versus them. You know, it's as cheesy as it sounds. The reality is the only way we get out of this is by working together. And so we have got to work across those aisles, work across those silos that we've created to try to make that happen a little bit better.
Yeah, if you're just joining us, we're talking with former Sauk County Health Officer Tim Lothar is with us. We're discussing the work of public health officials in this global health crisis and in this very political time. Join in at 800-642-1234. Tim, I'm wondering about burnout in particular. Are staffing levels adequate at the county level, or are you worried that there just aren't enough staff to do the job amid a pandemic? I know we've heard about a major shortage of contact tracers.
And I think that every county obviously experiences that differently. But there is a shortage of public health staff. And the reality is in Sauk County, I can speak best to that, having been there most recently in Sauk County. We are struggling with having enough staff to actually accomplish contact tracing. We, like many other counties, have sort of pulled back on how we do contact tracing because of the lack of staff. But even the staff that are there, this is all that they are doing. fact. They have been doing coronavirus-related activities for, you know, since March in Sauk County anyway, and they're not doing anything else related, largely, related to public health. And so burnout is absolutely happening. And so the support of your local public health workers, it's not just the health officers, it's the workers who are actually doing the work, is really what we need. And this isn't, you know, we don't need parades. What would be nice is instead of calling somebody, we don't get hung up on and called all sorts of names. We don't get vilified in the press. We don't get attacked in community meetings. You know, people get back to the time when, as simple as it sounds, where people treated each other as human beings and colleagues, and we could work things out. We seem to have gotten quite far away from that, and it's really starting to impact the frontline public health workers. And I think you're going to see, as you already have, a lot of folks leaving public health.
Let's bring in another perspective here. Kelly is joining us from WASA. Hi, Kelly. Good morning.
Hey. It's so sad to lose these workers because everything is going to fall apart. And we really, really appreciate and need these workers. I was an infection control nurse. And, you know, you don't expect the president to know all about infection control. But the first time I saw his I was confused by what he was saying. Anyway, but I think everyone's trying their best. I hope they are, but hand washing. You know, when we would quarantine a nursing home because the flu was affecting so many elderly, you know, we didn't have the government involvement. And what we pushed was the hand washing. We made everyone wash their hands continuously because that's where a virus spreads. You know, we touch money, we touch everything. And I have watched out in society as people adjust a mask and touch a tray of food that they're serving you.
And so what Kelly is saying, Tim, is just going back to the basics.
Well, that's really what it is that, you know, it's true. There's a book, I think, that says this. You know, it's really all you really needed to know you learned in kindergarten, and it's kind of true. When you don't feel well, stay home, take care of yourself. Wash your hands frequently and regularly. You know, don't cough around people. You know, all these basic activities that people should be doing, generally speaking, just to avoid any illness. The reality is, though, that COVID-19 is significantly more infectious and significantly more deadly than any of those other things we've been talking about. And so it becomes even more important that we go to the next level. And I am 100% agreement that I have COVID fatigue. I am tired of doing all these things, as I know other people are. But the reality is that the basic measures of wearing that mask and staying 6 feet away and not going to gatherings and staying home when you're sick and washing your hands, very simple activities that we don't really need to have a huge community debate about individual freedoms about, because it's really a matter of keeping ourselves and our communities and our neighbors safe and alive.
Kelly, thank you for the call. We also heard from Michelle in Platteville, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Michelle's a teacher and a parent with a child in her class who tested positive for COVID. The child of that parent is being quarantined, but that parent is not getting the child tested for COVID. And Michelle says that's stressful because she and other kids in the class have been in close contact with the student. And so Michelle says, I'm stressed out and I don't know where to turn to.
Yeah, and I understand that stress, and I really feel for the teachers and the school staff that are coming back and trying to educate our children. I mean, I am one of the many public health officials that believe that in-school learning is vitally important for our kids and our communities, but we need to be able to do that safely. And one of the ways to do that is we need to improve our access to testing so everybody can be encouraged to get tested quickly, easily, free. And that we make sure that we are quarantining and isolating people to keep them out of the schools once they've become a close contact or become a positive case. There's a lot of work to be done there.
When you say that you're pulling back on contact tracing, what are some things being done that are not full-fledged contact tracing anymore?
Well, for example, I mean, it depends on each individual case, but sometimes, for example, we will not call a close contact that we got from a new positive disease. We will ask that positive disease case to call their close contacts. And so if the relationship is there and we have the sense, and again, who knows, but we have the sense that that new case will call their close contacts, we will let them do that and then save the 10, 15, 20 hours it's going to take our staff to call those people and move on to another case. And so for that to work, it really does require lots of public messaging. It requires lots of community partners to also do close contacts, for example, in their business or in their school, so that public health staff can be left to deal with this huge rise in new positive cases, which is really where the focus has to be. We have got to get the positive cases isolated out of the community so that they don't spread this illness further.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Tim Lother is the former health officer for Sauk County Health Department. We've been looking at the impact of public health workers in this crisis. Coming up, we talk with a spokesperson for the Trump reelection campaign about why he thinks the president deserves a second term. As part of our presidential ticket conversations, we heard from a Biden surrogate on Tuesday. We'll talk with the Trump campaign right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we have presidential candidate conversations leading up to the November election. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Today we're hearing from the Trump ticket with a member of the reelection campaign. Mark Lauder is the director of strategic communications for the Donald Trump presidential reelection campaign. He previously served as special assistant to the president and press secretary to Vice President Mike Pence. What do you want to ask about his stances on policy and about the campaign trail? We're at 800-642-1234. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, Wisconsin is absolutely reeling from COVID. We lead the nation in new cases and hospitalizations. We have a field hospital open outside Milwaukee. What is the president going to do to stop the surge? What is his plan to deal with this health crisis?
Well, first and foremost, we are continuing to make sure that the states have the information they need to be able to take appropriate action at the local level. Also, we're also working to make sure that we have the therapeutics that are out there that are developed and available to our frontline responders, doctors, and nurses. And as we know, a vaccine is just around the corner.
Okay, so a vaccine is just around the corner. What will be the president's approach to deciding who gets the vaccine, and will it be mandatory?
Well, the vaccine is currently obviously in development, and what through Operation Warp Speed, you've got the federal government working with private partners and with the U.S. military to make sure that we are ready to distribute it as soon as it is approved by the FDA to get it out there. As the president has said, we want to make sure that our first responders, doctors, nurses, frontline responders, and also those who are in senior centers, nursing homes, they're the ones that can get to it first, because we obviously, those are the most vulnerable populations, and then making sure that we have the ability to get it out to the general public and so they can take it as directed by their doctors or as they choose.
All right. So in the meantime, what are states to do here as cases surge? What would you suggest?
Well, first and foremost, follow the CDC guidelines, which we have seen, which encourage social distancing, which encourage wearing masks if you are not able to socially distance. But we've also got to realize that we have got to get this country back to work. We've got to get this country back moving again, and that it's not an either-or choice. It's not either lock yourself in the basement or get back to life, get back to work, get back to school. We can do both of those things and protect those who are most vulnerable. And so what we're seeing is that we can socially distance. We can wear masks. We can trust the American people to make the best decisions for their health care, their own personal safety.
But when the president doesn't wear a mask,
information.
But when the president doesn't wear a mask, what kind of example is that setting?
Well, the president does wear a mask when he's in a position when he cannot be socially distanced or people are coming into close contact with him, as he has shown us on many occasions, he can wear a mask. But also, you know, the protections that are used around the president, with people being tested, people being kept at a distance, also create a different situation for him. And so what we're encouraging people to do is to take ownership of your own health and that of your family if someone might be of high risk tendencies. And so you can get back to work, you can get back to school, you can wear a mask when you need to. But we also don't believe that you should be forced, that two guys out who are hunting on the weekend need to be wearing a mask in the middle of the woods.
Okay, so President Trump is holding rallies in Wisconsin, in Janesville, over the weekend, where there, you look at the images, people are not wearing masks. So why is the president encouraging large gatherings when you're seeing just a huge surge in cases?
Well, what we see is a large number of people who are exercising their First Amendment rights to come out and assemble, to exercise their freedom of speech, to participate in our political process. And we provide temperature checks, we provide masks, we provide hand sanitizer to everyone who needs it. We encourage people to wear it. But we also trust in the American people, that they don't need a nanny state government telling them they have to do something. We'll let the American people decide what's best for them. And if no one's being forced to go to these rallies, and if they are of a high risk tendency, and we believe
that the campaign is putting them on,
we are absolutely participating in a presidential campaign, and we're going to take our message to the American people. And those who want to voluntarily come out and participate in that process absolutely have the right to do so. We encourage them to consider their own personal health, but we don't need a nanny state government ordering people to stay home and not participate in the political process. We'll trust the American people to make that decision for themselves.
We're talking with Mark Lauder, who is Director of Strategic Communications for President Trump's presidential reelection campaign. We're looking at presidential ticket conversations here on the Ideas Network, taking your questions about policy and strategy, 800-642-1234. Mark, let's look at election integrity. President Trump has resisted to committing to a peaceful transfer of power if he loses the election. His rhetoric has been confusing. It's been non-committal. Will the president accept will he accept the election results and commit to a peaceful transfer of power?
I absolutely disagree with that characterization. The president has been fully committed to making sure that we have a peaceful transition. In fact, the transition process has been going on for months already with both campaigns in anticipation of the outcome of the election. But what we're not going to do is commit to accepting what could be faulty, flawed, or skewed results that don't accurately reflect the count. Because what we have seen going on in many of these Democrat-run states is the complete abandonment of election law and just tradition. I mean, you've got folks in Nevada and Pennsylvania who are saying, well, as long as your vote arrives by the end of the week, whether it's postmarked or not, we're going to count it. In America, we don't have election week. We have election day.
FBI Director Christopher Wray has said, you know, the FBI has not seen any evidence of voting fraud, of widespread voting fraud. Why is the president spreading this disinformation?
Well, then I would ask the director to open his eyes and read a few headlines. When you see ballots that are being discarded, thrown out in the mail, there was a story in the New York Times, I believe, just a few months ago, where you actually had a Democrat operative talking about how voter fraud is real in the mail. He specialized in doing it, and that they even had post people on their payroll to discard ballots from people they didn't want. So we know it's real. And what we want to make sure is that every legitimate and legal vote is counted. And we want to make sure that it's counted when it's supposed to be, which is election day, and not a week later when you suddenly wake up and realize how many results or how many votes you might need, and then go out and manufacture them out of nothing.
Let's bring in Josh now in Eau Claire. Hi, Josh. Hi, Josh. Can you hear
Hello.
Us? Hi.
Yes, I can.
Go ahead.
My question is, what is the average person supposed to do when the Trump campaign holds large gatherings and allows people not to wear masks, and then they leave there, potentially exposing everyone else? I liken it to somebody choosing to exercise their free right to get drunk and drive down the road. It endangers everyone else around them. And why is this being treated as they get to choose, even though it impacts other people?
Mark Latter.
Well, what I would tell you is that if you are very concerned about your health and your safety, then take the precautions to protect yourself. If you want to wear a mask, if you want to wear stay socially distanced, then you can absolutely do that, and that is your right. And if you want to hide in the basement with Joe Biden, you are also able to do that. But for the rest of the America, for the rest of the people who want to get out there, exercise their freedom of assembly, their freedom of speech, their freedom to participate in our political process, that is not something we need permission from the government for. That is our right. And so for those who want to participate differently, choose not to participate, or to protect or take different precautions, that is also their right to do so.
Let's bring in Shauna now, joining us from Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Shauna.
Hello, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say that the Republican Party doesn't want a nanny state and says that no one should tell anyone to wear masks only across their faces, but the Republican Party will not allow a woman freedom of choice for her own body. And they say they don't want a nanny state? Please answer the question.
Shauna is bringing up abortion and the stance of Roe versus Wade, specifically, I would think, Shauna.
Right. If you don't want a nanny state, but you don't want to wear masks, really, and then you want to be inside a woman's body telling her what to do?
Mark Latter?
Well, what I would tell you is that by and large, the Republican Party stands for life. And we believe that every life is precious and every life is valuable, including that of the unborn. And that is something that this president proudly stands on. He is the most pro-life president ever. And that's not something we're also going to be ashamed of or have to defend ourselves against. We believe that every life matters, including the life of an unborn baby.
I want to look at the racial injustice protests, and we have seen across the country and, of course, here in Wisconsin and Kenosha in particular, the Jacob Blake case. What specific policies would President Trump enact as president to address this, and why has he not denounced white supremacy?
Well, that's absolutely incorrect. I mean, it's just a blatant lie. The president has denounced white supremacy on dozens of occasions. It's documented in national media interviews going back into 2015, all the way through the 16 campaign in the White House, and even again.
So how will he address systemic racism? What policies would he put in place?
The president has signed an executive order already talking about improving police training and making sure that any officer of the law who acts outside of their authority faces the full weight of the justice system. But I got to tell you, this is not an either or choice. It's not about being against social injustice or police brutality and or supporting the police. We can do both. And the president has shown that. He has stood with the men and women who put that uniform on and answer the 911 calls in our emergencies. But he has also called for the Justice Department to fully investigate and prosecute anyone who has exceeded their authority. And what we have seen going on in our cities, including in Kenosha, Minneapolis, and so many others, is complete anarchy. And it's because you've got radical, liberal, leftist leaders
very quickly
who have abandoned the police.
And very quickly, what do you think about the mute button tonight?
You know, once again, it's just what Democrats do when they don't like the outcome. They change the rules. The president will obviously continue to debate Joe Biden tonight. He'll talk about his record, prosecute Joe Biden's failures, and hopefully he'll actually make sure that Joe Biden answers some questions about packing the Supreme Court or his pay-to-play schemes with his family, whether the moderator brings it up or not.
Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Mark Latter is Strategic Communications Director for President Trump's reelection campaign. Coming up, we look at home ownership and the pandemic and housing insecurity. That's in a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Home foreclosures have fallen to historic lows as the CARES Act paused foreclosures on federally backed mortgages, which make up the majority of home mortgages in our country. And struggling homeowners can request up to 180 days of mortgage forbearance without penalty. But as protections are lifted, homeowners may fall further behind on their payments. And people who've lost jobs or had their hours cut could be at risk of losing their homes. Our next guest says wealthy landlords are ready to buy up properties as 3.5 million mortgages are in trouble. Ryan Ziember wrote the book Underwater, How Our American Dream of Homeownership Became a Nightmare. He's a writer for The Wall Street Journal, covering finance, energy, real estate, and more. And he talked with WPR host Keely Baltina. Your article is titled Millions Are House Rich But Cash Poor, Wall Street Landlords Are Ready. What do you mean by house rich and cash poor?
Well, you know, unlike the housing crisis from a little over a decade ago, when homes weren't worth what people had paid, now home prices have really risen in recent years, particularly this year. We've had some of the strongest home price gains in years, you know, year over year this summer, as people, you know, take advantage of low interest rates and you know, want to find a house in the suburbs to get that home office and, you know, a yard for the kids and the dog. And that means that people have a lot of equity in their homes this time around. The problem is millions of people are jobless right now. So we're seeing a lot of delinquent mortgages. A lot of mortgages ending up in forbearance. And eventually, you know, payments are going to have to be made once forbearance expires with lenders, or the government, you know, federal regulators say, okay, you know, lenders, you can foreclose again. So unlike last time when people were forced out of their homes and they couldn't sell them and the prices kind of kept falling because they were sold, you know, for fire sale prices on the courthouse steps, now you have a situation where people might not be able to afford their house going forward, their monthly payments, but they have a lot of equity in the home. So you could see some weird like forced sales where people actually walk away with some money, unlike last time where, you know, you might have walked away with a debt even after you lost your home. And the Wall Street firms that came out of the last crash, who bought homes by the tens of thousands on the courthouse steps and turned them into rentals, those companies have become so profitable that they want more homes and they're paying full price. So they're ready for those people to, you know, basically have problems maintaining their payments and have to sell or foreclose.
That's really interesting in your reporting, because you talk about how we're dealing with big time rental companies as opposed to what you referred to as mom and pop operations before. What does it look like to be a rental organization right now?
Well, it looks like there's a lot of room to run. These companies, as I mentioned, you know, the biggest, say 10 or 12, they probably don't have much more than 5% or so of all the rental homes in the US. And I'm talking single family properties. So, you know, your classic suburban home, basically. Most the bulk of those, and throughout history, were sort of like a small business, you know, the doctor or dentist in town, or the, you know, the heirs would, you know, you'd inherit grandma's house and turn it into a rental property, or maybe you'd buy a fixer upper down the street and have it for income. There was never really a way for like Wall Street to conquer single family residential like they did in commercial property, offices, apartments, shopping malls, warehouses. They kind of conquered all that and own a big piece of that, but they could never do homes because it was so hard to manage them. You know, they were expensive, but they got this opportunity to get started when they bought homes for 40, 50 cents on the dollar during the foreclosure crisis. And incidentally, that happened when the iPhone and the iPad and all this cloud, you know, mobile technology came about. And they were able not only to orchestrate, you know, one of probably history's great land grabs, but also, you know, to manage the properties efficiently thereafter. And so they've made this business now where they can afford to pay full price for a home and still make a good yield for their investors. And that's just, you know, right now, there's a mountain of money sitting in property funds that a lot of that money would go to buy Manhattan skyscrapers and shopping malls and things. None of those investments look really appealing right now. Those are very uncertain asset classes. But what's certain is Americans, there's a lot of people coming, a lot of millennials coming of age. They'll be moving into suburban settings with children that they want to get in good schools. And so they have this demographic sort of wave coming at them. And that's just really been accelerated by the pandemic, where people want to have space between their neighbors, space within their homes because they're spending more time in them. And, you know, interest rates have never been lower.
Ryan Ziember has written about how economic pressure because of the coronavirus could force property owners to sell, and how rental companies are handling this. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
Ryan, do we have any numbers to help us understand how many people are facing this situation financially?
Well, you know, there's millions of mortgages in forbearance. What we don't know is, you know, there could be some where lenders have, you know, requested not to make payments for some reason other than job loss. But the big jump in it has coincided with, you know, the economic shutdown due to the pandemic. On top of that, there's a lot of people that don't know that you can, if you're having problems paying your mortgage, unless you have certain, you know, very high end, very pricey mortgages, but the bulk of Americans can call up their lender and request up to like a year of forbearance. It's hard to tell what those numbers are, but that could be an additional, you know, upward of a million additional people beyond the millions who have basically raised their hand and told their lenders, we can't make our mortgage payments right now.
Do we know anything about demographics? I mean, is it affecting different races or people who live in specific areas differently? Do we know that yet?
I don't think we really do yet. You know, it's a big cross-section. This whole pandemic has really shown that, like, maybe some people who thought of themselves as being in the middle class maybe aren't there anymore because of the way that certain businesses have been affected more than others. And then, you know, there's this class of people who now are like sort of working from home, the sort of professional class. And then there's people who, you know, maybe need to be in service and stuff who are out of work. So we're probably seeing it more down the lines of economic strata. And, you know, working at the Wall Street Journal, we see just a steady procession of big companies announcing huge layoff numbers from, you know, airlines, manufacturers, oil companies. So, you know, these are jobs. These are well-paying, like, middle and upper middle class jobs that are being lost. So it's not all, you know, the poor and then the inner city, and that this is really, you know, affecting, like, what we would think of as the middle class and sort of redrawing those lines.
Well, and if you are able to get out of a mortgage that you can't really afford anymore, less scathed than you would have 10 years ago, then you become a renter and then you open yourself up to those vulnerabilities that you didn't have before.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things with having a corporate landlord that's really different than, you know, traditionally you might have a landlord that's somebody that you know, see in church or your kids go to school or you see them around town. And maybe you have a personal relationship and there's flexibility and negotiating built in. Now, I'm not saying these big companies want their tenants out. In fact, their ideal is to have tenants stay for as long as possible. They lose a lot of money getting rid of people and turning places over. So they're doing everything they can to keep tenants in. But, you know, they also, these are corporations. Their duty is a fiduciary duty to their shareholders. And they have pressure to constantly earn more money and to beat targets that Wall Street analysts set for them and what investors expect. So they are under pressure to raise rents in a way that, you know, an individual investor, somebody who lives in town probably isn't, you know, in that same boat.
Lots to look forward to and keep an eye on. Ryan, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And that was finance writer Ryan Dezember talking with WPR host Keely Baltina. We have a link to Ryan's article at WPR.org/mornings. Just a heads up on our programming plans, the Senate Judiciary Committee will gavel in at 8 this morning. They are expected to approve Judge Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court and pass it on to the full U.S. Senate. You can hear live NPR coverage on the NPR news and music stations or go to WPR.org to hear that live coverage. Coming up, we talk with the editor of Black in the Middle, an anthology of the Black Midwest. It brings the voices of Black Midwesterners front and center through personal narratives, through commentaries and art. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.